Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Father Christian Brocato, and our conversation revolved around the wonderful, at least in our view, TV series on Netflix, The Crown. The Crown, as you probably know, is about Britain's royal house. And throughout multiple episodes, there is a theme of religion. And you probably know that Queen Elizabeth is the titular head of the Anglican Church, the Church of England. And I thought, you know something, in all the years that Common Threads has been on the air, we've never done something specifically on this tradition. So I thought, this is a perfect opportunity. A little bit about our guest, Christian Brocato. He is originally from Helena, Arkansas. His education consists of time spent at the University of Cincinnati, University of Minnesota, and the Aquinas Institute of Theology in St. Louis. And currently he is the rector of St. Mark's Episcopal Church here in Grand Rapids, Michigan. So once again, we welcome to Common Threads, Father Brocato. Hello, sir.
Thank you, Fred. So nice to be with you.
Certainly. So last week we were talking about a variety of things that take place in the Crown, as well as the history of Anglicanism. And as we left off, we were talking about divorce, because in the Crown there is an instance where Princess Margaret wants to marry a divorced man. And Queen Elizabeth, she tries to go to bat for her. She meets with the several heads of the Anglican Church, and they lay down the law that unless Princess Margaret is willing to give up everything and no longer be considered a royal, that she pretty much has to abide by the understanding that there is no divorce, and ultimately, she does go along with that, and she ends up marrying someone else, Lord Snowden. My question is, at the end of the last episode, you were comparing it to, you were comparing the understanding of divorce with in Anglicanism with the understanding in the Roman Catholic tradition. And we were running out of time, and I didn't have to ask you, do you have the option of annulment in the way the Catholics do?
We do not. We do not. That's I think particular to the Roman tradition. But if someone were to come to me for counseling and talk about divorce, you know, I would, it wouldn't be something that we would accept lightly or very easily. However, in our Book of Common Prayer, it very clearly says that we accept divorced individuals. As I said, I think in the previous episode, my guess is that my sense is that royalty, monarchs, the head of state. Even if you think about Prince Charles and Camilla, things have changed quite a bit, I think, in the last probably 20 years in England, and it's far more accepting of divorce than it was before. But if the Anglican tradition adheres very much to many Roman Catholic traditions or principles, then divorce is not taken lightly.
And, you know, that's right. I think I didn't bring up Charles and Camilla because I haven't gotten that far. And and I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
I know that it might be a spoiler, but you're done with season four, right?
Not yet.
Oh, you're
no,
not? Okay.
I think the third or fourth episode.
Okay. Because I'm not there yet. I was going to ask you to clue me in. I'm dying to find out if Charles ever becomes king. So.
Oh. I don't know that.
They haven't filmed that episode yet, huh?
The presumption is that he will be king, but that's the presumption.
Right, I know, but they've been presuming for decades. but yeah, that is true, that Prince Charles married a divorcee, And the church is made peace with that, correct? I mean, that's not going to keep him from the throne.
Right, right. And that would probably not have happened, you know, 30 years ago.
Right, right, exactly. Because, of course, we get a wonderful history of Albert, King Edward the VII, I believe, the Duke of York.
Yep. Yeah,
and that whole escapade with Wallace Simpson—that was very fascinating. I'd known about it, but not in much detail, and I'm glad I know that now. So another thing too—you were talking about the break of the Americans from the British in during the Revolution, where they broke from the Church of England, yet maintained the same spiritual tradition, correct?
Correct, including bishops. But, you know, a fascinating thing is that the bishops, of course, that were here during the Revolution and prior to that, were from England. I mean, so they had pledged allegiance, if you will, to the crown. And so breaking with England then meant for the Church of England in the United States that there had to be real change. Obviously, bishops and priests here would not be able to pledge allegiance to the crown, and so thus then was founded the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States. And as I said before, the actual document that actually exists in a display case, an archival display case in the Parish House of Christ Church, Philadelphia. And it's just fascinating to see this statement with the break and the actual signatures of those who actually signed that document. So in many ways, Christ Church, Philadelphia, which is a magnificent colonial building, is the mother church of the Episcopal Church in the United States.
You know, what I find fascinating is I realize that the concept of the so-called divine right of kings is not something that people think about anymore. At the same time, watching The Crown, and yes, I know that many events have been fictionalized, but still, there seems to be a very spiritual aspect to the monarchy. Even Elizabeth says at one point, and I have to believe that this is true, that she answers only to God.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you can comment on that. If you think that people generally, people who are members of the Church of England, believe that this is in fact the case, that there is a spiritual dimension. Clearly, the coronation, which I'd never seen a coronation before, but of course it's in The Crown they replicate it, and I would suspect they replicated it quite historically correctly. It is a deeply spiritual event. Any comment on that?
The service when she was crowned, it was actually filmed, and so you can watch. I mean, it actually exists. So I think that the series actually did quite well because it is a deeply spiritual. It takes place, you know, in a sacred place with sacred trappings and the service and all of these things, and you know, she's given the orb and the scepter, you know, all of which in some ways are historically linked to the figure of Christ the King, who oftentimes is seen with an orb and a scepter, you know, and all these trappings of vestments and copes and all of these things that go with all that. It is a deeply spiritual and moving thing. I think that if you were to survey most people in England, they would say, you know, we don't really know, but it's not really important to us. I think, however, in The Crown, and I think this is true of Elizabeth, I think she's a deeply spiritual person. And I think that if even she might not want to talk about the divine right of kings, but as a spiritual person, and we sort of know this in part because of her relationship with Dr. Billy Graham, but we know that spirituality is extremely important to her. So my guess is that at her coronation, she felt the divine presence in ways she had never felt before.
Another fascinating episode, I think this is season three, is where we get to explore the prince's, the Duke of Edinburgh, his spiritual malaise and his reconnection to a life of faith, at least to some degree, where they get a new dean at their church. And that I found that interesting. The title dean, is that like rector? Do you know?
The deans are usually the heads of cathedrals. Rectors are usually full-time heads of more often than not larger parishes. But deans usually are the heads of cathedrals. So our cathedral, Washington National Cathedral, is an Episcopal cathedral, and the head person there is the dean.
Okay, thank you. So they get go on.
Yeah, and St. Mark's here in Grand Rapids, which by the way was founded in 1836, was the cathedral for the Diocese of Western Michigan from the early 1900s until about 1960. And so my office actually is the dean's office, and so there was the dean of the cathedral, the dean of St. Mark's, and then there were other priests that actually served under him, and he was him, are usually called canons. So oftentimes in the polity of the Church of England and Anglican Communion, deans and canons serve in cathedrals.
All right, thank you for that. So getting back to this episode, we find that the Duke of Edinburgh, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, is going through, as I mentioned, a spiritual malaise. He admits to his mother, who, interestingly enough, was a Greek Orthodox nun, not when she bore him, of course, but...
Of course not. One would hope not.
Now, of course, if you really wanted a fictionalized account, maybe that's what they would do. But anyway, she asks him in a previous episode, how is your faith? And he says, dormant. And I believe it's the next episode we find out how dormant it is. He just seems to abhor going to church. And of course, with the dean that they have at that time, we would imagine a lot of people would have a challenge going to that kind of church, because he seems kind of addled, a bit senile. And then they bring in this more dynamic younger priest, and he asks Henry for the use of a building. And he agrees to it, and I won't go through the entire episode. The bottom line is, Philip goes through a deep, deep spiritual malaise, which, fascinatingly, they correspond to the moon landing, and who knows if that's true or not. But apparently... they took this work of offering this building to the church, and they created something. Do you know what that something is that still is maintained to this day? And in the credits, it states that Philip is very proud of this work that he helped start.
Boy, I don't offhand. I have to say, I don't.
Okay. But do you remember the episode? You do remember that some sort of collective happened, and it's still maintained to this day. I think it's used as a retreat center, and at the credits it said something like it's used for conferences or just gatherings for philosophical and theological purposes. And it was a very uplifting episode, because you do see a sort of redemption. I don't know how deep it was in real life for Philip, but nonetheless, I think it was quite inspiring.
Yeah, and just you know, another comment. You know, you said given the character, at least as the dean is portrayed, you know, the Church of England to this day is undergoing, you know, a pretty serious decline and transformation. My former parish, which was St. Peter's Episcopal Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is where I was before I came here, I had a parishioner who was from England who went back to his home parish and came back and said, I have to tell you, the liturgy, the worship is so changed that it was unrecognizable as Anglican. And I say that in part because I think what's happening in England, at least, is all kinds of liturgical experimentation to try to revive the church, which certainly in the late 1900s was and is still in great decline. So so for the Duke to have to be ambivalent about spirituality or ambivalent about religion, he would have had good company.
I would imagine. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Father Christian Brocato, and he is the rector at St. Mark's Episcopal Church, and we are talking about all things Anglican, particularly as it may relate to the TV series The Crown. Another question I had, not related specifically to the series, but and we touched on this before off air, maybe a week ago or so. And that is, here in Grand Rapids, there is a church that is called St. Paul's Anglican Catholic Church. And so one wonders, is it Anglican? Is it Catholic? I mean, I'm curious, do you know, are they a part of the Anglican Communion?
No. There have actually been breaks with the Anglican Communion. The Anglican Catholic Church would be much more Roman Catholic than it would be Anglican in that sense, and its theology as well. Any number of different things would be distinguishing characteristics. However, the liturgy would probably look and feel very much as it does here at St. Mark's, which is relatively formal and traditional. I would guess at St. Paul's. Obviously, I work on Sunday morning, so I have not been to St. Paul's. But my guess is that it's probably a very formal and very, very traditional liturgy. And the theology much more conservative than that of the Episcopal Church.
Yeah, I attended a service there, I'm going to say maybe 30 years ago, and it was much more Catholic than most Roman Catholic churches that I've attended. Very formal.
We tend to sort of categorize the Anglican Church or the Episcopal Church, high church, middle church, or broad church, and low church. St. Mark's would be more toward a high church liturgical experience, whereas my guess is St. Paul's would be certainly a high church experience. That meaning, in terms of movement and vestments and incense and more the trappings of what the Roman Church actually looked like prior to the Second Vatican Council than even it does today.
Yes, yes, but
only in English.
That's
but it would
correct.
Be in English. Yeah.
Yes, that is correct. But I don't believe they're actually in communion with Rome either. I think they're neither fish nor fowl when it comes to that.
It would be surprising to me that they would be, but I don't actually know if they are or not.
Because neither one of you have copyrighted those terms, Anglican or Catholic. One of the things that we see in The Crown several times are the royal family going around the world to the various dominions of the British Empire when they had one. And I'm assuming that with the growth of empire also grew the Anglican Church, correct? That there was a strong religious presence. And I'm curious if you know, did those seeds sprout all over the world? Are there strong Anglican churches, or they may have different names, such as Episcopal or whatever, but did they sprout? Are they still strong?
Yes, in fact, the Anglican Church in Africa is very, very strong. Not dissimilarly from the Roman Catholic Church, which seems to be growing sort of exponentially in the Southern Hemisphere, so too is the Anglican Church, particularly like in Africa. And it's also very conservative, very, very conservative. You know, one of the things that's a real challenge in the Anglican tradition, in the Anglican Communion, are different beliefs, are different belief systems. Let's say. The Episcopal Church in the United States, for the most part, one particular instance would be LGBTQ rights. The Anglican Church of Africa does not have those same kinds of understandings, and in some of those dioceses, and there are not women priests, and there certainly would not be gay or lesbian priests. So those are distinguishing. So. The Archbishop of Canterbury has a huge job holding this whole Anglican Communion thing together, but he, just as his predecessor, absolutely committed to doing whatever needs to be done to keep the communion together. But that said, each of the churches within the communion function pretty much independently. So the Episcopal Church, we have our own presiding bishop. He is an incredible human being, Michael Curry, was elected, you know, through a whole process of election. He is the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, which is found in something like 9 countries, by the way. Sometimes we just think it's in the United States, but it isn't. It's in multiple countries. But the communion itself is a kind of a loose communion. One of the things, as I said, I think in the previous series, was one of the things that unites the communion is a common thread, and that is the Book of Common Prayer. And though it may look and feel somewhat different in all of the churches, it is essentially the same structure, the same kind of book, which is unique in the Anglican Church.
So there may be, well, there are. You mentioned last week, for instance, you are in communion with the Evangelical Lutherans here in the United States. Are there more conservative movements, Anglican movements, here in the United States, if one wanted a more conservative religious community?
Oh, absolutely. There have been any number of parishes and even a couple of dioceses that over the last several years, primarily when Gene Robinson was elected the Bishop of New Hampshire, an openly gay partnered individual, was extremely difficult, not just for Episcopalians, many Episcopalians, but it fractured the worldwide Anglican communion that a diocese would elect. And again, our bishops are elected. They're not appointed in the Roman Church. They're appointed by the Pope in Rome. They are not appointed. We are everybody's elected, including priests, as I said before. And so the Diocese of New Hampshire elected Gene Robinson, and then that gets approved, by the way, and part of our polity is that every 3 years we have a general convention where Episcopalians from all over the world are elected as delegates. But there are bishops who are elected, and then there are other delegates, lay delegates. And so Bishop Gene Robinson's appointment as the Bishop of New Hampshire was approved by the International or the National Episcopal Church at a general convention. That was extremely difficult for many, many Episcopalians. And a lot of people actually left because of that. And as I said, it fractured the Anglican Communion as well, because there are many, many other churches within the Communion that for whom gay rights are simply not at the top of their agenda, I guess is one way of putting that.
And finally, we just have a couple of minutes left. I know that there has been significant dialogue over the decades between the Anglican Church and Rome. Is there a motivation for communion with Rome, or are people in the communion, in your communion, are they pretty happy with the way things are? We have, you know, a cordial relationship, but we don't really feel the need to actually be in communion with Rome. Are there movements within Anglicanism that says, no, if we could reach agreement, we'd love to?
I guess it would be kind of a middle-of-the-road sort of response to that. I think it may be a both and. I don't think that most Episcopalians or Anglicans see much value in being united with Roman Catholicism. The polity is radically different, as we've said. The Pope is considered the vicar of Christ on earth, infallible in certain ways, and that was one of the great battle cries of the 16th century. You know, was really an anti-Pope, because people simply didn't believe that there was historically a figure, a person on earth who could claim to be the vicar of Christ. That's a really tough sell for a lot of people in the Anglican tradition.
I'm sure.
Yep.
I'm sure. And we are actually out of time right now, Christian, but I want to thank you so much. This has been a very informative episode, as last week's was as well. So all the best in the new year. And
well, thank you, Fred, and same to you. I appreciate it very much.
Certainly, certainly. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella. Father Christian Brocato from St. Mark's Episcopal Church has been our guest today and last week as well, talking about the crown and all things Anglican. Please join us again next week right here on WGVU.